understanding some of the fractionation of those different that same corn kernel into those different in-use products that serve humans, you know, determines what we have left to feed animals. And then one of those key differences, obviously, is the protein is there's both corn protein, right? It's just how concentrated is it, how much was removed, and then so the protein dynamics from the amino acid standpoint are similar. There's certainly some dynamic differences, but the amount of starch and fat, sugar and fiber that are in there obviously are different. But it's certainly been a steady move up, and there's a, you know, we kind of fed it to milk cows for a while, then we realized maybe that wasn't a good idea because of some of the fat production challenges, and then it became our favorite dry cow and heifer feed. And so now we're back thinking about, yeah, how can we find ways to have it help us manage costs really in maintain milk production in milk cows.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Volac, unlocking ruminant potential through nutritional solutions for a sustainable future.
Hi-D from DSM Firmenich optimizes vitamin D levels to increase milk yield, enhance calcium to phosphorus ratio, and strengthen immunity. With early detection in health, reproduction, and feeding, SmaxTech future-proofs your dairy operation. Priority IAC, the only company bringing the fields of microbiology and nutrition together. Adiseo USA, producers of SmartAmine M and MilkPay.com. More milk and higher conception rates. Contact AHV to take uterine health to the next level. Lallemand Animal Nutrition, partnering in microbial solutions for a changing world.
Hello and welcome back to the Dairy Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. My name is Barry Bradford from Michigan State University, and today I'm very happy to welcome to the show Steve Martin. Steve is the founder and a nutritionist with the Dairy Nutrition and Management Consulting Firm. And Steve, it's great to have you on the show.
Yep, thank you for the invitation. Glad to be here.
It was fun talking with you earlier how you're somebody that listens to some of these podcasts. Is there one that sticks in your mind as like kind of a surprising, something you heard that was kind of surprising?
Well, that's a great question. Anytime Dr. Santos is on, then I'm, maybe not sitting down and taking notes, but I have listened to a couple of his more than once, just trying to drink from the fire hose that comes out of his brain, right?
That's how I feel.
No doubt. Yeah, he's a generational guy, I think, in our industry, and really glad to know him. And he's one of my favorites for sure.
Help us get to know you a little bit. So you do nutrition work for dairies mostly. How did you end up in that line of work?
I think a lot of us that are in the South in the dairy industry, it'd be interesting to take a poll. I think a good chunk of us probably grew up in the beef cattle world and maybe even the beef cattle education. So I grew up in Alabama. My dad was an ag econ professor at Auburn. So I grew up kind of in an environment that you're used to. Had a family farm down the road, 45 miles. It was a combination of cattle and small row crops and timber. And beef cattle was my thing growing up. Dairy skipped a generation in my family. My dad, my granddaddy was a DHI milk tester in the 1940s in Alabama.
Oh, wow.
And then he ran the dairy for the Alabama School of the Blind in Talladega. And so we got some cool pictures from all that. But for me, it was beef cattle. And so undergrad at Auburn and then master's with Bill Ellis at Texas A&M. Focused on beef cattle, but working on grazing cattle supplementation. And then every project he did had lots of marker ideology, marker technology, marker approaches worked in there. So we had spent a lot of time wearing whatever the badge is, the dosimeter badges, right?
Okay, yeah.
Working on that stuff. So
radioactivity, yeah.
Yes, right. That's right. Yes, stuff you probably couldn't do it today if you wanted
that's
to.
That's correct.
It makes me a little nervous as I get older. But after grad school, after a master's degree, I worked in the cottonseed industry for a trade association, NCPA. And during that time, I met Dr. Nate Smith. It was the head of dairy research at Purina back in those days. And so I called him one day and said, hey, I want to get back out in the field. You know of a beef job in Texas? That's where I wanted to go. He said, no, but I know of a dairy job in Stephenville, Texas. And so anyway, I made the shift from beef cattle to dairy cattle after having no dairy classes in any of my schooling there in Stephenville, Texas in the early 1990s. And yeah, it's been a lot of great producers and other colleagues in the industry that have kind of taught me the dairy side. And, you know, now it's been 30 plus years, so it's kind of what I do.
Better feed means better outcomes. This is why Lallemand Animal Nutrition, a global leader in microbial solutions, developed the Clean Feed approach. Lallemand protects your silage with research-proven forage inoculants, offering expert advice and services to maximize your investment and profitability. Their cutting-edge microbial solutions help boost feed efficiency and production, ensuring you are supported from field to feed out. Learn more at cleanfeedapproach.com.
Today, if I'm not mistaken, Texas is the number five dairy state. And I can't tell you cow numbers right now, but I don't know, 800,000, I'm not sure. But where can you give us some sense of where it was 30 years ago?
You know, if you talk to people in the industry, Stephenville was so pivotal, I think, in the early 90s as dairies were really starting to get big. And Stephenville was the hot place. I don't know, from probably 90, most of the 90s, where people were coming from California, they were coming from Arizona, they were coming from Holland. A lot of first-generation Dutch dairymen that milk a lot of cows today had their start, you know, milking 50 cows in a flat barn, you know, somewhere out in Erath County, Texas. So, you know, I think when we went there in the early 90s, there was 300 dairies in Erath County. And I think today there's the same number of cows, maybe, but obviously way less dairies. And so a few people have survived. It's not the most, it's a great place to milk cows, except for, you know, maybe June through October, has a lot of benefits. But, you know, a lot of those people that really wanted to expand and milk tens of thousands of cows maybe left and went to the High Plains or the upper Midwest. And so I think it was a great place for me to learn dairy, because dairy was shifting. So I was working with some dairies that still feeding in the parlor, you know, had been doing that for generations there, because Stephenville had a dairy shed before they ever got big. And yeah, you know, just kind of grew with it. And so now our group is based in Texas, based in Amarillo. We have two nutritionists in Texas. I live in Alabama and Florida, kind of depends on the week. And then we have a nutritionist in Southwest Kansas as well. And then a handful of support people around. So yeah, the High Plains is kind of home for us. So got a lot of Texas in me, even though I'm from Alabama.
Well, one thing I think that's interesting about dairy is I think that the facilities are becoming sort of more uniform across the country, although they're not completely. But what we still see is, because of differences in climate and soils or whatever, like pretty wide disparities in the types of diets we feed right around the U.S. And so it's really interesting for someone like you that's got a team across a pretty broad geography. You see a fairly wide range of different diets. But I think one thing we're going to talk about today is probably one of the more predominant byproducts, you know, fed to ruminants in general, but also to dairy cattle is distillers grains. And how did you first get started using distillers grains? Or what part of the country was that when you were first playing with that?
I'm sure it was Central Texas, you know, back in the 90s. I tried to do a little bit for an article I wrote recently. I tried to do a little bit of a history. And then the previous episode that you had with Dr. Rosentrader from Iowa State, he did a great job of this. But I was trying to figure out when it was, you know, through the renewable fuel standard and the things that come out of Washington that drive corn acres and drive some ethanol production and thus the distillers. But, you know, I feel like, somewhere in the late 90s, we started seeing it, as an ingredient that was more common. And then not long after that came corn gluten. And so I really think it's interesting to understand kind of the differences between those two products and how they have, you know, wet corn milling is where the gluten comes from, the high fructose corn syrup. And then dry corn milling is where the distillers come from, and understanding some of the fractionation of those different, that same corn kernel into those different in-use products that serve humans, you know, determines what we have left to feed animals. And then one of those key differences, obviously, is the protein is there's both corn protein, right? It's just how concentrated is it? how much was removed. And then, so the protein dynamics from the amino acid standpoint are similar. There's certainly some dynamic differences, but the amount of starch and fat, sugar and fiber that are in there obviously are different. But it's certainly been a steady move up. And there's a, you know, we kind of fed it to milk cows for a while, then we realized maybe that wasn't a good idea because of some of the fat production challenges. And then it became our favorite dry cow and heifer feed. And so now we're back thinking about, yeah, how can we find ways to have it help us manage cost really in maintain milk production in milk cows.
I think every nutritionist I know has at least one story about the first days when distillers grains came on. And if you just looked at the cost per megacal of energy, it was like, wow, we got to feed this, right? And so people would throw it in and, you know, there'd be train wrecks here or there. So I'm not going to try to make you tattle on yourself, but maybe a competitor had a farm with a major issue. Do you have any examples?
A friend, right? Yeah, I had a friend that dropped butterfat a whole point in 6 weeks or whatever. You know, my specific example with that, and I even remember what dairy this was at. It was between Hyco and Hamilton, Texas, and down in that Stephenville area. And it actually wasn't with distillers, but it was with something called high fat product, which was kind of a cottonseed replacer. Okay. And so it was like the worst of, you know, the only reason we can feed so much cottonseed that we do is because of the package that it's in and the slow release that it does in the rumen. So you take and you make that with soap stock and soybean oil and cottonseed meal or soybean meal and soybean hulls or wheat meals, whatever, and it looks the same on paper. And you know, that was what I remember. It's like I didn't think butterfat could drop that fast. Yes, gotcha. Very, very impactful.
And so, yeah, you talked about people sort of learning that it's tricky to feed to lactating cows, but you know, people have learned a lot through that time. So you said you're now coming back to looking that in lactating rations. Do you have some rules of thumb that you use, or how do you approach that to where you can say, okay, I'm comfortable now that I'm not going to go off the rails here?
Yeah, so I think it's understanding the diet that you're using it in for one thing, and then also realizing that all distillers' products are not the same. So we'll talk about that just a minute, because I think there's a lot of ingenuity going on in that area that some people are probably aware of. But for the first thing I'd say is that if you think about the altered pathways in the rumen when you have too much 18-2 fatty acids, you begin to wonder, it's like, okay, which rations is that most problematic in? And I think we've known for a long time those are higher starch, lower roughage rations. And so it could be that the sweet spot for one dairy may be some amount of 18-2s and another dairy may be half as much or twice as much. And so I think that's real. I think having cottonseed in or out of a ration is a conflicting factor that makes you do the math a little different. So I think that's something to pay attention to as well. But we should say that in the last 3 or 5 years, Dr. Rosentrater mentioned it too, that a lot of ethanol plants are starting to use centrifuges to spin some of the fat out. So if you go back and think about the corn gluten process versus the distiller's process, you know, in the corn gluten process, they actually separate the germ from the rest of the corn kernel. And so that's where the fat goes. And that's why it's lower fat. And then a less complete starch removal so that you're not quite concentrating the fat as much. But in distillers, where you have a near 100% starch removal through the fermentation at the ethanol plant, there's a lot of fat there. And, you know, I think that we would say, 9, 10 or 11% would be very normal. Perhaps maybe some of the wet distillers that we get to feed, maybe on the higher end of that. But if you'll spend some time looking at distillers analysis, they've definitely come way more down to like 7 or 8. And I suppose, obviously that fat's valuable, right? And so even just a regular DDG or wet distillers plant's probably shipping you a lower fat product than they used to, which is a negative for heifers. So like if you've been depending on distiller's grain with, 32% protein and, really high NEL or NEG to raise heifers to, feed things like corn stalks and wheat straw and cotton burrs and stuff like that. You got to make sure that, this isn't what it is. And your NEG is less than it was just a few years ago. So making sure that's right in the model, I think, is pretty critical. I mentioned the stuff about the product. So I think maybe 2-3 times a year lately, I get a phone call from somebody, usually from Kansas or Nebraska, that has a new distiller's product that they would like us to look into. And part of the reason I have interest to know maybe a little bit more about this than average is I have the opportunity to do some work for the makers of Novameal. And Novameal is a product that basically takes distillers and pulls out most of the fat. So, you know, used to they would say they take it from, you know, 8 or 9 to 2 to 3, and now it's from maybe 7 or 8 to 2 to 3. But, you know, that helps with the 18.2 issue, and then also there's some bypass protein increases. Similarly, you know, there's several groups in Kansas that have done some fractionation where they've and we've had high pro DDG for a long time. Okay, I mean, high pro DDG has probably been 15, 20 years. But this is something different they're doing, where they're fractionating some of these fiber parts out and concentrating the protein. And then the other thing you hear in that conversation, and I don't know if it's specific to specific brands and processes, or if there's something that's been in distillers all along that we just never really thought of, is the fact that there's a fair amount of, you know, how much of the protein is coming from yeast bodies. And clearly yeast bodies would have a different amino acid balance and amino acid, you know, RDP versus RUP type dynamic in the rumen. And are we thinking about that correctly? And is that new, or has that always kind of been that way? So there's a lot of different special ones, I think. Some of them are more focused on protein. Some are more focused on fiber or fat reduction. But, you know, I think it's great. It's great to take a product and make it better. And I think we can feed it better, you know, with some of these enhancements.
Typical fresh cow incidence of clinical hypocalcemia is 3 to 6%, while subclinical hypocalcemia affects 50% or more mature cows. Based on cutting-edge research, Exelite offers a new approach that is build effective and easy to use. For more information, visit www.protecta.com.
We have to think about the fatty acids, obviously. We started with milk fat depression, which is a function of the mostly the fatty acids. On the protein side, how do you think about that? I mean, I think people typically started with their main protein source is soybean meal. You're swapping that out for distillers, and you have these trade-offs. How do you approach that side of the formulation?
Well, I'd say that's the part to me that has been most eye-opening lately. So if you wanted to tie a quick bow on the 18.2 fatty acids part, before I go to the amino acids, is there was a I don't know if it was a meta-analysis, and I think it was a poster, it may have been an abstract, but it wasn't peer-reviewed, but it was a JDS publication by Fernando Diaz 7 or 8 years ago that basically took a lot of JDS studies and looked at, you know, there was a linear reduction in fat yield and percent with 18.2 or linoleic acid increases.
Yep.
And what that told me was I thought surely there was a safe zone. Right. I thought there was a safe zone, but it didn't appear that there was in that study. But I think most of us still operate like there kind of is. I mean, there's a lot of 18.2 in corn silage, right? We can't, you know, unless you're feeding a high alfalfa diet. If you're feeding a high alfalfa diet, you probably have a little bit of more room to feed a little more 18.2. So to the protein side, you know, this has been an evolution in my mind. And I really feel like I'm right now kind of back, really trying to, someone's like, I'm going back to school on some of the amino acid stuff. And you know, trying to get and read and understand and talk to people like Mark Hannigan and Cornell and Dr. Van Amberg, and just trying to understand what's driving these, you know, what's driving the C and CPS for one. And then the realization I had one day where like a light came on, it's like, you know, the stuff that is true in Blacksburg, Virginia is not necessarily true in Ithaca, New York. And surely I'm not the only one that's noticed that. And so I think you have to kind of pick your way through a little bit of that. And, yep, you know, two great scientists and leaders in our industry. And I think, I mean, in a real world, two people can't always be right about the same thing. But with all the different variabilities that happen in dairy cows, yeah, maybe they are both right. Depends on the situation. So that's the approach I've taken. But I am using a C and CPS model. And so I think the NASM changes to me were very positive for corn protein. And when I first was presented with the idea, like of the Novameal or some of these other ones, it's like, you know, why would I want to increase the bypass of a terrible amino acid balance? That's what we were all taught in school.
Yeah.
It's like corn protein is horrible. You don't really need it. You know, keep it as RDP. The microbial protein would be better. But I think now, particularly when methionine, you know, lysine's important, don't get me wrong, but if you can't read through the NASM and not wonder, you know, the cow seems to have some flexibility. And I'll get way over my pay grade of explaining some of these things that are in the NASM and some of the stuff that's come out of Hannigan's lab. But, you know, my cowboy boil down on that is like, yeah, the cow really needs methionine for a lot of things. Methionine is really critical. Lysine is very important, but it seems like there might be some flexibility in the lysine areas that relates to branched chain amino acids. And perhaps, you know, we've gone back to the essential amino acids and maybe focusing on what has been termed those core five. And the presentation I've seen that I think explains this the best is we all learned the barrel and stave approach. And actually, I didn't know this till recently, but that was actually first created by a plant scientist, not an animal scientist. But, you know, what's the first limiting nutrient? And I think when it comes to amino acid supplying building blocks for milk protein, it doesn't seem to quite be like that. So I think it's good news.
Right? Simple, right? Yeah.
It's good news. The cow has some flexibility, which isn't surprising. You think about other ruminants, wild ruminants. You got deer living in the mountains. You got moose in the mountains, and you got water buffalo over here in a muddy pond in Africa. I mean, there's all kind of things going on inside that rumen. But I mean, honestly, when it gets down there to the mammary level and the stuff that's happening in there, yeah, we got different amounts of solids and different kinds of milk from different species. But honestly, the fact that there's some flexibility in there, I guess it doesn't surprise me. And I think I'm happy for it. So I have probably gone from looking at lysine and methionine and metabolizable protein to looking at MP milk support, methionine, and then maybe a total essential amino acids. And then trying to ratio those not so much to each other, but ratioing those either to MP or ratioing them to ME to make sure that as we raise the protein side milk support that we're also correctly raising the ME milk support. Because honestly, still in most rations I do, you know, if you're trying to formulate some energy density, that's really where the pressure in the formulation is. Particularly if you optimize. If you optimize, you're going to find that trying to maintain an ME minimum is really where all the fighting happens within the optimization program.
Let's talk about that a little. I think, you know, people that maybe formulate every day may follow some of that, but there's lots of people out there doing different roles that maybe don't even know quite what you mean by optimizing. And like, what does that look like? Do you have software that does that?
Yeah, and I know I keep referring back to your other previous podcast, and I would commend that to people, but Dr. Rosentrater said several times optimizing the use of distillers, and he was thinking about it in a broader sense about, you know, think of new ideas of how can we make distillers better, whatever. When I say optimization, I'm talking about within NDS or AMTS or your feed company's software, either using a linear optimizer or a nonlinear optimizer, and basically letting the you know, you may know cows better than your computer. You may know what the perfect manure pile looks like. You may know what the perfect TMR looks like, but the computer is always better at math than we are. And in reality, the computer is also more creative than we are. So if we give the model really good bounds on the things that we want, and you have nutrients that relate to each other, and if they're both right, that means that a lot of other things are right, and you set those things up in the model. I think that people would be surprised at how some of the corn-based protein products, particularly in this new NASM thought process, might figure. But you got to remember that just because it's in the NASM, from the standpoint of what you might learn reading the NASM, that doesn't mean that the CNCPS, milk support formulas are going to be the same. So there's that nuance in there, or that art of trying to balance those things. And our experience is going to tell us too. And you know, these things usually save money. So when you're, I don't know if you've looked at milk forecast, but you know, I think that every investment with a great ROI for the last 18 months that we've really enjoyed and had fun with, that's not going to last. I think we're going to start getting questions. It's like, hey, all this palm fat and rumen available methionine we're feeding for these crazy high butterfat levels, you know, where's the point at which, you know, that doesn't make money? And don't forget, an economic and biology principle that has opened up in my mind recently is, you know, all the time in a production system, the last unit's the most profitable. So the last pound of milk, or if you're a feed mill, that last ton of feed. But, you know, that's not the way it works in supplying nutrients in the cow to make that last pound of milk. You know, that last gram of amino acid is actually at probably the lowest efficiency. And so I think that's a really interesting tension there between those
it's
two
different principles. Different in an engineering scenario, right?
I don't know if that's something you've thought about before, or or maybe everybody else knew this and it just occurred to me last week. I don't know.
I like to talk about it when I teach like basic nutrition about it's a frustration for humans trying to lose weight, right? Because your body's fighting you the whole time. You're actually getting more and more efficient with energy as you cut back on caloric intake.
Exactly.
Huge data behind that.
So, I mean, one thing that I think that the industry needs to know, and the formulators and their clients, to be honest with you, is, are nutritionists optimizing? Are they trying to be, it's honestly just an exercise of opening up your brain to maybe feed a different ration than you love to feed. You know, maybe the ration that we all love to feed is 30 cents higher per cow than the ration that can support the same milk. But it does bring risk into the situation, and nutritionists do not like risk. Like, we have enough risk already, so why rock the boat? And so I don't know. I'd mentioned this effort that Dr. Hannigan and I have kind of started, and it's mostly an idea I had, and he's been gracious enough to help here kind of at the end of his pre-retirement, partial retirement. But we're working on some optimization strategies and trying to maybe do some teaching. We do some webinars and some things on nonlinear and linear optimization. And so people have interest in that, we'd love to talk. And yeah, you might be a competitor, you might be a feed company, whatever. You know, we're all going to learn to feed cows better. And I think we'll all get better. And I think we need to get better. Finances are going to be challenging.
Yep. No, I like that idea. One thing I want to bounce off you, it strikes me a little bit that one thing about the way the dairy industry hires nutrition consultants actually disincentivizes creativity or trying new things. Like, you just kind of brought it up. I bring this up a lot. It's like, you know, your number one job selfishly is to keep a client, right? And that may mean you turn away really great opportunities because you can't be completely confident that it's going to work. And maybe if you have a really tight relationship with a dairyman, you can bring that conversation forward and talk through it. But do you think with the consolidation of the industry, do you think that we'll see farms or businesses start to say, okay, I'm going to allocate a few pens a year to like being more creative and trying, like invest sort of some R&D space into my business? Do you see that happening?
I do, and we've done it, right? I mean, we probably find ourselves doing that as in our consulting group, where we end up doing some field trials for companies that have something they want to do. And, you know, if you have dairies with micro machines and lots of pens and different things, I mean, you can do a lot. And, you know, you get in individual milk weights and different things. I think that it doesn't take a lot for a modern dairy to actually have a legitimate field trial. If you take the average dairy and you spend just a minute with somebody like you or somebody that's good at statistics, you might say, hey, how can we design this actually so that there will be some statistical power? You know, stuff that I would forget immediately. But it's like, if you do all this work and then you do just a little bit more work, maybe you can actually have something that would have some statistical legs to it. That we could really maybe learn something, and then you're risking it with less cows, and know that every salesperson for amino acids or any kind of feed technology, they feel the resistance of the nutritionist. It's like, yeah, I'm all about it. I'm with you 100%. I hope they'll try it. I just hope it's their idea, so that if it doesn't work, because I mean, you get a 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 cent investment on a 10,000 cow dairy. I mean, this is not small money that you're asking them to invest. And if it's your idea and it falls flat, it's like, yeah, that's going to be a rough meeting. And so that just makes us risk adverse. And saving money and saying, hey, we're going to support the same milk with less feed costs does have risk, because you might have, but it'd be a slower like if it doesn't work, you may not know immediately, but you might look back and say, yeah, our, you know, our peaks are down, you know, our repro is down 3% year over year. Yeah, maybe we shouldn't have taken that 9 cents of feed cost savings. But then it's like, okay, let's just, whatever it is, let's just put it back. So it's not like, you know, you just cost me $100,000 because of this idea you had.
The psychology is different, right? If you write a check, then if you lost it.
It really is. But yeah. It's fun to think about these new ideas and not just do stuff the way we've always done it, I guess.
It's time for our famous three. We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Your partner for extra animal performance, Bergenschmidt Animal Nutrition. Our Yeast 40, ruminal and intestinal double modulation by ICC Animal Nutrition. Accurately measure individual cow feed efficiency with the newest advancement from AffiMilk. Visit AffiMilk.com to learn more. That's AffiMilk.com. Natural Biologics delivers cost-effective solutions to improve health and productivity, helping conquer the rumen health and immunity challenges your animals face. Exalit, a novel product for the management of hypocalcemia. It's uncomplicated excellence. Evonik Animal Nutrition, sciencing the global food challenges. Adiseo, a global leader in nutritional solutions and the provider of Smartamine N, the best-in-class rumen-protected methionine product for dairy producers who want to optimize milk production, capture more value from their components, and maintain their lifetime performance of their herds. For more product information and to calculate your return on investment when you balance your feed with amino acids, go to milkpay.com.
Well, thanks for sharing your thoughts on that. All right, we've got, of course, our famous three questions that we have to throw at you. So the first one is, what's your favorite dairy-related book or resource?
Yeah, so I guess I wouldn't be in the club if I didn't say the NASM, right?
Yeah.
but I'm going to qualify that by saying, as much as I really like, kind of geeking out a little bit on some of these details, because I also really enjoy the fiber side as well and fermentation adjustabilities. Probably more comfortable there than I am in the fatty acid or the amino acid space. But, you know, if you really sit down and get into the NASM, you know, this is not comfortable reading. And it's a struggle. I'm not a good reader anyway. Most of what I do, I listen to it. And so if I'm truly honest, I've always had the NASM in reach, but I'm sure that I've learned more out of the NASM by listening to podcasts and presentations and going to meetings, because it's just a lot.
It's very dense.
I don't want to get hung up on stuff that doesn't matter. And so I appreciate the industry and podcasts. Any companies that sell amino acids or fatty acids, they've obviously had a lot of incentive to try to teach nutritionists and producers some of these finer details. And so I'd say that, that's it. But, you know, time spent, like mine's not all marked up and got, you know, flag pages and stuff at all. It's almost more like something that looks good that sits on my desk. But I do, and especially the tables in the back, right? You got to have those tables for quick reference.
All right. What about your favorite book or resource outside of ag?
I don't know. There's several things that came to mind. And maybe there were, can I say, not outside of science, but outside of ag. And the science happens to be ag. So
I'll let you bend the rules a little.
So, you know, I obviously was prepared for this question, listened to the podcast, and I gave it some thought. And as far as a book, there's a lot. I don't read well, but I listen really good. So those of us that do what we do, we spend a lot of time in the truck.
Yeah.
And I'm probably I get a lot of awards from Audible from listening to stuff. And in fact, I find that I listen to some stuff over and over because it just, if I like the reader and it's interesting stuff. So there's a book that I listened to that I was commended to recently. It's called The Wizard and the Prophet.
I love that.
So you know about it, right?
Yep.
So I don't know if it qualifies for being non-ag or not, but at least half of it is, because I'd say that the prophet was a little less ag and the wizard was a little bit more ag. But yes, Charles C. Mann, and basically if you're not familiar with it as a listener, it's basically looking at these two guys back in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, you know, when technology was coming on, and there was basically two approaches. One is would be like a carrying capacity, like we might look at a ranch and say, this ranch has this amount of rainfall, so we can have, you know, one cow per 4 acres or whatever it is, and so then you stay within that. And then the wizard would say, okay, well, hey, we have this asset of this ranch. What can we do with technology to make it so instead of it being one cow per 4 acres, it can be one cow per acre? And how do we achieve it? And I mean, it, you know, that general topic through population, and I mean, it world, I don't know, world climate, world politics and some things. It's just a crazy good book. And then when they got all this figured out, so then I was at a meeting the other day with Dairymen, and I asked people to raise their hand who ever heard of Norman Borlaug, who is the wizard in the story. And I don't know, 25% of the people raise their hand. And so I would commend, just learn about Norman Borlaug. How about that?
Yeah. Being from Iowa, I was a little, you know, we were a little bit skewed that way, but
I figured that you would be, and that's not why I picked it. But,
what really amazed me about the writing in that book is how good a job he does of presenting, I think, you know, sort of almost, yeah, very competing worldviews, but in a fair way on both sides. And like,
yep.
You can't really tell which way he leans by the end of the book, you know?
Well, I agree with that. And he says early on, he's like a science editor for a big newspaper. And so he says early on, I'm not going to tell you which way I lean. And then like near the end of the book, I mean, literally it just stopped. So I'm listening to it, and it's like, and then my mind is like, well, you know, it went on to some other book, and it's like, well, what happened? And so I went back to the end and listened to it again. And yeah, I think the way that he may have written a summary chapter and then just said, hey, I'm not going to put it in here because it might make you know which way I lean. But great book.
Great answer. All right. Last question. In your opinion, what sets successful dairy professionals apart from those who are less successful?
So I'm 59. I've been doing this for 34, 5 or 6 years. And I think it's passion and learning. Passion and learning. And, you know, I think every once in a while I'll hit a stride where it's like the hunger for understanding more is almost a little frustrating because you can't, it's like, okay, I want to understand this. Then I get out the NASM and start reading it. And it's just like, I have no idea what I just read. And so I got to call somebody to help me understand it. But, you know, I think if we're going to do things better, you know, things are changing. Who knows how AI and algorithms are either going to save the world or kill the world. We got to make sure you spend some time what you think about that. But yep. The science is changing. We need to change with it. Whatever it was you learned in school, if it's more than last year, it's not right anymore. And so, but you gotta have passion too. And you gotta, here's a little thing. You gotta show up on time. You gotta do stuff. You gotta be a people person. You know, I don't care how much you know, in most cases, if you're not reasonably fun to hang around with, or at least average, people will find somebody that is just as smart as you that's a little more fun to be with, and that's probably important too.
Great advice. Good insights. Thanks so much, Steve. It's been a really fun conversation. Thanks for joining on the podcast today.
Yes, very, very good. Glad to do it. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
So again, today's guest has been Steve Martin from Dairy Nutrition and Management Consulting, and I'm Barry Bradford from Michigan State. If you haven't already followed or liked this podcast, make sure you hit the button so you don't miss the next episode. And we'll see you on the next Dairy Podcast Show.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.